Welcome back to Dateline New Haven on WNHH-FM. I'm Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven and Hamden tick. We got a gentleman today who's just starting to make our community tick in a big way, and he's got a story to tell. Ludwig van Beethoven has been dead for quite a while, but the Black Beethoven is going strong. That's the nickname for Dunn Pearson Jr. He is in town, been here about a year in Hamden, New Haven. He's putting together a big event in New Haven that we're going to talk about, involving equine-assisted psychotherapy. People are going to meet horses in DeGale Field and talk about horse-to-human trauma healing. Boy, is that interesting. But we're not going to talk about that first, because there's a whole backstory to Dunn Pearson. He got to be known as the Black Beethoven, as the keyboards and producers for the OJs, a big group of my youth, and had a great recording career, too. Dunn Pearson Jr., so nice to meet you, and welcome to Dateline New Haven.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Paul. I feel like I've just made the big time.
You've made the big time. Now, you might have been touring the world. You might have had 26 gold and platinum awards, which, in fact, you did. But you are now on Dateline New Haven. Welcome and congratulations on arriving, my friend.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
So, Dunn Pearson, how did it come that you moved to our area after the storied career?
Well, you know, it's I keep it simple. It's love brought me here.
Ooh. Wow. No, I can see how you won those Grammys. So, like, what way did love bring you here?
Well, I met a wonderful, wonderful woman. Her name is Dr. Shelley Jones. She's a professor at Central Connecticut State University, and I got to plug her book. She has a best-selling book called Women Who Count. So, but our romance took off, and now I'm here, and I'm so happy to.
You settled where in Hamden? Did you settle?
We're in Hamden.
Which part of Hamden?
Oh, I don't know the different parts. What street? I'm right off of Wintergreen.
Okay, so you're near New Haven, and also it's interesting to me, you were the keyboardist for the OJs.
Yeah.
And this day, you're playing the keyboards here, too, but at the United Methodist Church in Hamden.
Oh, absolutely.
What's that like? Tell me about that.
Oh, I just did my first service this past Sunday at Hamden Plains, and the pastor there is Pastor Jeremiah Paul, and he was actually the second season winner of The Voice. So so we both had sort of similar careers, because after his win on The Voice, he went on tour with Alicia Keys. So we have a little background there in terms of connection, if you will. But in concerning me, it's wonderful. I actually played for a sister church in New York, Highland Mills United Methodist Church.
And what songs did you play on Sunday?
Cry Me a River and things of that nature.
Did they Cry Me a River in church?
Yeah.
I didn't know that you do that as part of a church service.
I think that was the name.
Now, tell me about, so obviously you're a musician, so that's an important way to express yourself, the thing you do, even though these days your main gig, I understand, is this marketing agency that you run, which does a lot of big time work.
Yes.
For national, McDonald's, United Airlines, Wendy's, and Get Cool and the Gang going. But yet you want to play church. You want to play keyboards in the church. Why do you want to play keyboards in a church?
Well, it's a very interesting but quick story. I was born in, raised in the Methodist Church in Cleveland, Ohio, which is where I'm from. Born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother, took me to church every Sunday, and that's where I basically grew up. So it's like full circle to me. And the short answer, of course, is that I just want to give back to the Lord, and thanks for the blessings that I've done. And so any way that I can serve by playing my music, It's good for me.
Though. How is it different playing Cry Me a River for, 50 people, 100 people in church on Sunday?
Yeah.
And touring the world with the OJs and playing a top 10 hit. What's the difference? What's the same?
It's actually the same in the sense of that you're still trying to make a connection with your audience. That's the main goal, no matter where you're playing and no matter what venue. And the same is if you can make a connection, or I can feel the crowd, the audience, whoever that is, whichever way you want to call it, it's still just the same as fulfilling as all. I mean, obviously, the only difference is that you just have more people. When I play Madison Square Garden, I obviously get 20,000.
When did you play that? When did you play Madison Square?
Many times with the OJs. I play basically every arena in this country, or basically in this world.
And what song did you like playing best with the OJs? What was your favorite number?
My favorite number was a song called Let Me Make Love to You. Mm. But the OJs are basically known, of course, which is for Money, 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 and Love Train. So those are big hits for our group and so forth and so on.
What I loved about Love Train growing up was That was the hardest song to sing well if the song wasn't playing. The chorus.
Yeah.
The chorus does not have
exactly
a very easily replicable melody.
Well, Paul, you know what? You're so funny. You know, you must have those in-tune ears because I used to tell them, and I still to this day, I said, what it is, I'm going to be very technical because I'm in Black Beethoven, but the second chord is very difficult to ad-lib on or to sing along.
What is the chord?
Well, it actually starts, the first chord is C, and then the second chord is D. So that doesn't necessarily...
Oh, so it goes up a step rather than staying within the key.
Right, exactly. So I call it like the Stevie Wonder kind of thing. Like, you got to be able to notice, you got to be able to
because
sing
I
the
used
melody.
To laugh so much if I ever heard myself or someone else singing that song when it's not on.
Right, exactly. That's correct. That's right. And that's the reason why.
Whereas Money, 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 just put on the falsetto, you're there, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, money, speaks for itself. But that's funny. You have those kind of ears. Because I said that's the reason why they don't do them a lot of those award shows and things that they, you know, when you're like, well, you always have all of the people come up and they all sing all of the stars.
You don't want Lady Gaga up there for Love Train.
Yeah. That's the reason why. You get in that ad lib. You're trying to ad lib.
You
on
can't.
That
you
scene,
you got to still
that
get
that D chord that came in. You be like,
Well, tell me about Let Me Make Love to You. Why is that your favorite OJ song?
Well. Because it's one that always got the crowd going. I mean, obviously, you know, especially in those days, you know, it was all about connecting with the ladies, making sure they had a nice evening out. You know, when you come to these concerts and you pay that money to come to these shows, you know, the ladies go through a lot, and people don't really understand. I guess well, probably women do, but you know, of course, they go get their hair done, they get a new outfit, you know, they got their makeup on, you know, so they really dressed up, They're really coming there to be really entertained, and we always understood that. So our connection was to make that good, and then of course to make it a little easier for the man. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So basically, we were the foreplay for the man. You know, so made it easy, make it a nice night. You know, you got your lady out. You know, and we got it warmed up, and obviously, Let Me Make Love to You.
What years were you guys playing? Were you in the band when you're playing Madison Square Garden? Was that late 70s, early 80s?
In the 70s, between like 74, 75 to 80, you know, those
that was a golden period, especially the 74, 75. I feel like the mix of pop and R&B at that time, and you got Stevie Wonder on one end, you kind of got, you know, some of the more conventional acts on the other. I really thought it was a golden age.
It really was.
Stylistic.
It really was. It sort of boomed. It was a booming time. Everybody felt that, you know, I guess with the politics of what was going on behind the scenes and all of it, it just all sort of meshed, and it was like a coming together. And, you know, and music, of course, is always the foundation. It goes all beyond all color lines and all of that. So it was a reverence, and I could even feel it. Like, I always talk about it, like one night we arrived in Chicago, and we were pulling up to the hotel, and there was more than an normal amount of people standing out front. I was like, wow. Well, now we got all these people, you know, just waiting for us. And when we got out the thing, we realized, no, that was for the Rolling Stones. We were all standing in the same hotel. But again, the connection between our band with their band and all that, we all got together, everybody. You know, we just all with fellowship, and that carried on to many, many cities.
And there was so much love in the music. Like Babs Earl Zivy, who's sort of our main host here on WNHH-FM, she talks about that period. She used to do a Muntown Monday. She said, that's when they used to say nice things about us in the songs.
Absolutely.
And the music, too, was really loving music.
Right, exactly.
And I think it's something about, you know, the 60s, early 70s gave way politically, in the culture. But I think there was this spinoff that went into popular culture.
Yes.
Where for a few minutes we could all be one community build each other up rather than knock each other down for advantage.
Right. That's right. That's right. And Paul, to accentuate that, even for us being the musicians or the people that were given the message, it was like we were all amazed at how I knew their songs and they knew my songs, you know, and we weren't necessarily connected with the genre. But the biggest or the most fun parts, I would say, is that at the hotels, many times we would all just jam, you know, because we could just be free. Whereas when you're playing, I'll use Madison Square Garden to make a quick example. When you're playing Madison Square Garden, the person that's sitting way up in the nosebleed, causes a limitation for us to move. Because if I just want
to screens don't do it.
Yeah, because if I happen to move 3 feet over to the left, well, of course, the cameraman and the light man doesn't know that, so that person up there can't see it. So it was more restrictive. So everybody, when we got together in these hotels, you know, we would just all jam. And it didn't matter what the music
was. Tell me
was,
your favorite, most memorable hotel jam session.
Oh, that would be with Sting, I believe.
Sting?
Yeah,
he is interesting when you look at where he went after Police. Because the Police, they were going in interesting directions musically.
Yeah.
And then Andy Summers did this whole kind of classical avant-garde thing. Oh, yeah.
Man, listen.
So when was it with Sting? What hotel and what happened?
Oh, let me see. I think it was somewhere in the South.
They're not going to hold you to the date.
Yeah, you don't hold me to the date. I think no. It was somewhere in the South. Somehow Tennessee, Memphis sort of comes to my mind. But the circumstances was that he just happened to be in town and staying at the hotel, and we were all just sort of gathered. You know,
which hotel was it?
Oh, no, stop.
You don't remember a chatter room service?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
And what round, when was this?
I would say this was in the 70s as well. This was back in the 70s. And
he wasn't that big yet until late 70s, early 80s,
yeah,
right?
like 70. Yeah, late 70s. It was about in that time frame. Was in, maybe
so that's
in
when he was in his superstar mode.
Yeah, you know, just, you know, but... The whole thing of it was that he brought an energy to it, and we were, like I said, we were equally impressed that he knew our songs. That was the first thing. So when you make that connection, then we all just sort of jam. I mean,
so where do you jam in the hotels? Is someone's room? What instruments do you have?
No, in the lounge.
So they have instruments there you could play.
Yeah. Like if there's a lounge act playing, of course they didn't mind deferring to us. You know.
Remember what songs you played with Sting?
Oh, I don't remember, man. I think we might have just been jamming on some of our songs, and he might have just, you know, just joined in. But the whole thing of it was that,
you know, I like him. I think he's good. You know, he got feels. You know, he sort of has the ballad song. He has the kind of the Police did things with rhythm and chords that were a little different for pop at the time.
Oh, absolutely.
Playing off some of that new wave energy, but very accessible.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, oh, absolutely. But, you know,
but the fact that it connected with the OJs and that he had to know your music is sort of how he got there. Is
right,
very interesting.
Exactly, right, exactly.
Melody,
right.
And,
yeah, very, very, very interesting. Very interesting. And so it's you know, like I said, music is always that universal language. So
right.
it has gone on
for years and years. So we're talking to Dunn Pearson. Anna Navis Wynn points out, thanks for listening, Anna. Dunn Pearson is an amazing person. We're trying to learn a little bit about that because he's new to our community. The last year he's moved here. He's known as the Black Beethoven because he's had a storied career in music as a pianist and an arranger with 26 gold and platinum awards to his name. And he's done movies. He's done TV. He's done Broadway. And he's also... has a marketing agency in New Haven and Hamden, which this weekend is going to have a really interesting event at the Gale Field Park about horses to humans trauma healing. So now you were at Kent State.
Yes.
Studying music. What year was that?
I was in Kent in the 70s.
But not 1970.
Yeah.
You were
no,
little too
I came
thankfully
70, 72 I started in
yeah
72.
So 1970 was not, May 4th
was May 4th
people were gunned down
yeah
by the,
absolutely yeah four dead in Ohio the Isley Brothers
yes although that was Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Well, the Isley Brothers did a cover
on there you go
yeah,
you
they,
see
yeah, they did
you
a cover.
See
oh,
I didn't know I want to hear that
yeah they did a
so
cover.
How did they do it differently from Crosby, Stills, and Nash?
They did theirs, I would say, more the contemporary sound of having the electric guitar, because that was the, you know, the peak of the Jimi Hendrix movement. Mm-hmm. So it had that.
So they went a little acid rock.
Yeah, more.
It's
yeah.
So interesting.
Yeah.
You said Isley Brothers, and I said Crosby, Stills, Nash.
Well, there you go. Right, exactly.
And because like I'm trying to think how you get from It's Your Thing to Four Dead in Ohio.
Yeah, they did. They
so what was like? You go as a college freshman, 1972. You got these music chops. You're on this campus. Was it still charged from that event?
Oh, every year. Absolutely still charged. I mean, it's ironic that you're talking about it. We just had wasn't able to attend, but we just had homecoming this week. But I'm part of the planning committee for next year, and we're planning to actually try to bring the Isley Brothers back, and we're having a huge celebration that will be extended from the May 4th thing. So we're adding all of these historical perspective.
Did you read about the woman who was in the famous picture? They interviewed her a year ago on the anniversary.
No, I didn't.
And she was talking about how she was a runaway from home.
Oh.
And it was kind of really interesting. She was just trying to help that person. You know, the iconic photograph of the guy laying on the ground.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. They put in a beautiful, wonderful museum there at Kent State. an honoring of the May 4th. They call it the May 4th Memorial. It's absolutely wonderful. If anybody's passing
through, your mind as a student was on music. Were you majoring in music?
I was majoring in music.
What was the goal?
I did orchestration, so I went there for composition. And
because you were classically trained.
I was classically trained, yeah. And so the founding OJ's member gave me a suggestion when I got to college that I should expand and learn how to write for orchestra.
How did you know him?
That's a quick story, but I'll go back to the beginning. At age 15, I was involved in a group called the Ponderosa Twins, and we came out at the same time as the Jackson Five. So it was the same kind of little setup, and we toured together.
So you're already touring at 15?
I had toured. Yeah, we had actually part of a million-selling record. So we did a rendition of Sam Cooke's You Send Me. So that's how I met them. And so when I was in high school, I was president of the marching band and this, that, and the other. And I was also doing these recordings. And I started to have to arrange the music for the marching band. Because, of course, we didn't want to play the stuff that was in those, you know, the normal stuff. We wanted to play the current tunes. So I started doing that, and I started to figure out that I had a niche for writing for orchestra. So that's basically what I did. So when I went to Kent State, that's what I learned how to do. And that's when you're talking about my amassing the 26 gold albums and things of that nature, they're basically predominantly for my arranging and doing movie scores and commercials and so forth and so on.
You're the first African-American composer to produce a hip-hop commercial for McDonald's. You produced commercials for McDonald's, United Airlines, Wendy's Super Bowl Chicken Nugget with Kool and the Gang. You've done TV, Fox TV's New York Undercover, HBO's Head Office, Mariana Melvin People's Identity Crisis, at Oprah's Native Son, which I watched. That was good. Insisting they call it Oprah's because that's not the main character, but she was Oprah. But at 20 years old, you didn't make it out of Kent State because opportunity called. You were 20 years old. You're learning arrangement at Kent State. And what pulled you out of college?
What happened was, in my senior years, it was very interesting, but yeah, the job opened up for the OJs. I had already been working with them, you know, doing recordings and arranging, like I said, but the actual live performance gig opened up for me to go on the road with them. And so I chose to go on the road with them.
And then you stayed on the road.
And then I stayed on the road.
What was it like being 20 years old, being on the road? Must have grown up kind of fast, huh?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's an experience that I find now, looking back on it, that very few have actually had that opportunity to experience, you know?
What'd you learn from it?
Oh, listen, I learned about how you make connections and how you conduct business. The business of music and entertainment was at the forefront of all of this, as well as the artistic value, because what I've learned is that every little part of it in a production makes the whole thing. So that's what I learned. In other words, I learned that the entire evening is a performance, but it's everything that's entailed from it, from the beginning, from the first ticket sold to the last note that's played in the music. It all connects together, and it takes all of those elements to come together to make a performance, and also to make a business.
So musically, you were the arranger, thinking what different parts would play.
That's right.
Exactly. And then you branched out into the business to also talk about what the ticket sellers and the advance, the A&R team, whatever they're called, they're getting. Make sure it all happens. So you had a career as a composer, as a performer, and then you branched out. When did you form your marketing agency? And it's called now. You have a new agency, or you had it all the time?
I'm fairly new. So I have it in maybe 8 years now. It's about my eighth year.
And what's it called?
It's called All Done Advertising.
Well, I like that.
It's called All
Done.
D-U-N-N. D-U-N-N. That's right. That's my first name. All Done Advertising.
And how did
we get everything done?
How'd you move to that?
Well, I was already scoring a lot of the commercials and things of that nature, but I just started my own agency because I realized what I was just saying a second ago, that my talent, not only in the advertising part of it, but understanding the marketing of it, because, of course, I was part of all of that. And what I did, Paul, to be blunt about it, is that during the off times, like in between the travel and all of that, I spent a lot of time, and I made myself to be part of booking the rooms. I took on extra jobs for the OJs, just so that I could learn and understand the business. So then I started to realize, okay, this is how you move people. This is how you connect with people. We have the same connection. So those same values and procedures also works in the same thing with advertising. It's the same. It's the same thing. I tell everybody when you talk about the hip hop commercial with McDonald's, I say this, that McDonald's was very simple. When I worked with them, it was very simple. If you want a hamburger, their thing was, when you see these golden arches, you pull right in there. We got a hamburger for you. And that connection and that still stands today. If you want a hamburger, you see those golden arches, that's a place where you can pull in and get a hamburger. So I keep it simple, and I do that with all of my clients. I make it very simple. You have to have something, of course, and then you have to build trust in your brand. So that's very
So important. I realize I should have booked you for an hour, man, because the time's already going out. I'll make sure before you go, we go all the way to this weekend.
Yes.
So Sunday from 11 to 3 at the Gale Park, the Gale Field Park in New Haven.
Yes.
There's going to be an event called Horses to Humans, Trauma Healing for New Haven Communities. What is that? Well, and how did you get involved with this?
Okay, so I got involved in this by meeting the founder. Her name is Patricia Kelly. And she has a program in Hartford. And to make a long story short, very simple, her vision was that she wanted to give an experience for the young black kids that were not involved in the regular. She wanted to make them have the same experience in life that whites have had in terms of riding a horse. And the experience is very simple, but it's very touching. What she does is that she empowers the kid by having little chores. If there's nothing else but feeding the horse, wash the horse, walk the horse around the barn. In other words, those responsibilities made them responsible adults, as well as, of course, keeping them off the street. So she made that connection. Again, here we go with that connection. So she touched my spirit when I went to her place in Hartford to understand how this is actually working and to see those kids being interactive with the horses and all of that and what they get out of it. They carry a certain pride about themselves, and it's something unique. That was the uniqueness of it, because their imagery was not to see a lot of people that look like them to be riding the horses.
And what's the trauma part?
Well, that's the part of the trauma. So in other words, what she does is that her program, I would say, has expanded over the years. So now many of the systems that are in place, she takes some of those kids that are having traumatic lives, have traumatic experience, some things that have happened to them, and she pulls them into the horseback riding thing to give them an alternative, a more of an outlet to release some
so
of that.
So this Sunday, you're going to be in the park
so
kissing
the
ride horse.
This Sunday, right. So
and will they hook them up to do it on a big, long-term basis?
Yeah. So the thing of it is, on Sunday, you'll be, if you come to the call field, you will be able to hear her and another doctor, Rebecca Cohen is her name. The two of them have teamed up together, and you'll be able to understand their whole program and what they plan to do, what their goals is, to bring that Hartford program here into New Haven and to do the same thing going
excellent.
To these
well, we'll try to be there those, at the Independent right, so to cover
gotta,
it.
Yeah, you got to
come. That's awesome.
You got to come and see it.
Boy, I enjoyed meeting you so much. I want to talk a lot more. You'll come back, man.
Oh, come back, Paul. You know how it is.
Dunn Pearson, what an addition to our community.
Oh, thank you, Paul.
So psyched to have you here. Thanks for chatting us. Don't forget to hit the Gale Field Park, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. this Sunday, October 10th. And you can be hearing more if you're at Hamden Plains United Methodist Church. Oh, how did you get called the Black Beethoven? How'd that happen?
Long story short, I do classical music, and I do the same thing. I showed how Backstabbers, the number one hit for the OJs, actually is the same thing as a Beethoven sonata. So the music is exactly the same. It's just a different application.
What they do.
That's right.
The smile in your face. Right, I actually used to think, I was a little kid when that came out.
Right.
I used to think about that song.
Right.
Well, I used to you'd be walking home from school or something. You'd be thinking about the lyrics.
That's right. That's right.
The smile in your face. Everybody's going to take your place, the backstabbers.
Well, that phrase right there is straight out of a Beethoven sonata. The music under. So if I could play classical on it as opposed to the R&B way to do it.
All right. Dunn Pearson Jr., thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for listening to us on Dateline New Haven. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience, a Hamden New Haven group, playing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass inviting you to fly free with us all day and all night long on WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.